The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
I'm looking forward to doing an audio-only podcast again. It's been a while since I've done one.
Yeah, and it is after we have done the video for a couple of times, I think more than a couple of times now, this feels refreshing and less distracting.
I just watched the third episode of All Watched Over by Machines of Loving Grace.
Right.
Which is also called, what's the subtitle of that? The Monkey and the Machine or something like that?
Yeah, The Monkey and the Machine, right.
And I found it to be very interesting, filled with revealing nuggets, you know, of information.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think that it cohered as an argument or as a story as well as the earlier two did.
Yes, that third episode stands out. And I was reading an interview of Adam Curtis on another website, and he also mentions about the third episode being they were suggesting that he removes that one from the series and just keeps the first two because they were more in line with a particular framework. So the third one kind of stood out, and so, but he kept it anyways and insisted that it remain because he liked it in that format to bring it out. Because, and then I was reading in the article that the review that you had sent me a while ago, even in that they talk about how the connections that Curtis is establishing over there, the computers need this all this raw material that is mined from the Congo, and establishing that connection through some kind of that, you know, some kind of a narrative that he uses in the third episode is actually quite impressive. I mean, it does, if you think about it, it's very tenuous, but it is still an interesting connection to bring forth. And I remember when I watched that episode, I was struck by that link he's trying to put forward over there. And that's definitely one of the striking experiences I had while watching that documentary.
There's a thematic link, but there's also, but I guess the way I would put it is that by developing a deeper reliance on computer technology, The unintended consequences of that were that the Congo fell into an even greater state of chaos and dysfunction.
Right.
Although I would have to say that those efforts to retrieve the minerals from the Congo were only one factor amongst many
mm-hmm.
that caused problems. I mean, it's not as though we couldn't imagine a situation in which mining, what was it, cobalt? Could be done in a way that wouldn't create massive disruption, and looting and marauding
right.
in a region.
And know? Wasn't there all that previous, I mean, there was also this build up to that story where he talks about, were there the Belgians who essentially in older times created some kind of a rift between the tribes that used to live in those jungles, and that kind of escalated into a, you know, tribal rivalry that that was fucked up because they first made that divide and rule, they applied that divide and rule strategy and created that political rift where none existed before, and then they felt the guilt of doing that. So to correct that, they essentially initiated a war and led to a lot of violence, and this commodity that they were all, you know, they were basically harvesting from there was essentially part of the, you know, what they got from it. And this primitive tribe basically just had their narratives change, and you know, you interfered with history in a strange way. And this is really very interesting, because I think this is you could say that this is an example of one idea successfully invading another idea and infecting it in a detrimental way, not in a symbiotic way, but in a detrimental way. So the Belgian political maneuvers basically should not have interjected or interfered with this tribe, and because they did, they changed their history. Like, you know, if you consider the language as a virus principle, they essentially affected that narrative, and that's really what led to all that violence. So that was a striking point. It's really it's hard to pinpoint when you're watching it or even reflecting on it a little later. But I thought that was quite a powerful connection that he made.
I feel as though I need to know more about the history of the Congo and Rwanda, because, you know, the Hutu-Tutsi conflict is in Rwanda, not the Congo. But in the Congo is, you know, this vast area in comparison to Rwanda. It has its own, I mean, how these borders are drawn and why they're drawn the way they are is an interesting question in and of itself. Like, when did Rwanda form as a nation? To what extent can it be considered a nation? That's probably another question.
Rwanda is a landlocked country located in the central part of Africa. People began settling in the area as early as 10,000 BCE. After several successive waves of migrations, Rwanda saw the formation of several smaller kingdoms in the 1100s. And by the 1500s, a larger and more centralized kingdom known as the Kingdom of Rwanda emerged. The Kingdom of Rwanda was ruled by the Mwami king, and the kingdom reached the height of its territorial expansion in the late 1800s.
Brutal massacres in the Congo to stop a more liberal, democratic, nationalist independence movement, and to maintain something like colonial control even after politically granting independence is worth considering. So I feel as though in one way this documentary, in terms of just Africa, is sort of skimming the surface. It's not it's not so much that the ideas of geneticists like Bill Hamilton had such a detrimental effect, or that the development of PlayStation technology and computers had such a detrimental effect, but that these things arising within a context of domination in Africa had, and then and not only in the context of the domination of Africa through colonial power, but also in the context of that colonial power dissolving. And the need for African nations to participate in a global market in which they're disadvantaged so dramatically from the start. All of that is what then maybe shapes these ideologies and sets the stage for them to have such detrimental impact after as well. Like, so it's like it sets the stage for Westerners to want to conceive of themselves as being machines without much responsibility, considering how badly things are going.
Right.
It's a way to wash your hands of the problem, to say, well, we're all just genetic machines and we don't really decide anything. And at the same time, that idea also drives further exploitation and domination and violence in that region.
True. And this whole imagery of machines and you know, invading primitive tribes in the wild, that brings up an interesting aspect of you know, archetypes used in fiction, science fiction particularly. When we talk about aliens and we envision aliens, most of the imagery is about these advanced beings with, you know, machinery and computational power that right now from our perspective is like just, you know, unattainable, and they arrive and they interfere with us just like we have interfered with, you know, other cultures. And that says that probably says something about the collective subconscious in how we perceive these events in history. So it's interesting because it's not just those two tribes that were being you know, taken advantage of by the colonialists. It was also the colonialists and these tribes forming this tension of tribal rivalry and, you know, culture immiscibility. So in this is like a dark version of the gods must be crazy, you know, the Coca-Cola bottle dropping and you know, changing the narrative of how they deified the unknown or the strange alien. So I find those are some very interesting offshoots that come off, you know, observing the story from a distance.
The story about the Belgian influence of the Rwandan people over the Rwandan people and the responsibility of the colonialists for setting up a divide and conquer strategy in the country and the region. One of the things that overlooks is the question, or doesn't answer, is the question of why those divisions in Rwandan society persisted even after the Belgians left, even after independence was granted.
That's what do you think? My guess is that it's because one of the things about cultures that are based on whatever mythological structures, you know, organize their communities in. It probably is very vulnerable once it has been invaded by something so dramatic, and it can never go back to normal because whatever the cultural narrative message is has now become fixed in the population in a way that it's impossible to reverse. So for example, India has never fully recovered from the you know, the British rule for two centuries, so that the dent that is caused, I think, remains and persists in an irreversible manner, like a scar or a trauma that is fixed in the historical narrative of that particular nation's psyche. So it's useful to think about all the nations as personalities and their collective characteristics expressing as personalities. I mean, right now, whenever I think about the United States, Donald Trump's image comes in my mind like you know, like instantly.
Not Obama anymore? Can't we still use Obama?
No, so that's interesting, isn't it? I mean, there was a time when it was Bill Clinton and there was a time when it was George Bush. So these are just like hovering advertisement effects that hang around in our head, it seems, that we kind of live through it as individuals and on a grander scale, this pleroma, the simulacrum is basically just throwing in images and imagery at us through television and computers and radio and podcasts.
Yeah. Well, I guess when it comes to this idea that there's a psychic trauma in a nation that they can't overcome, I would say that the history of the world is a history of one region conquering and dominating another and back and forth. I mean, there's some areas that are living under domination for much longer than others, but all of history is a collection of traumas in a way.
True.
And that Zizek has this interesting theory about trauma, which is that he uses Einstein's theory of gravity to try to explain trauma. And he says, you know, the theory of gravity is that what happens is that there's a mass of stuff. There's a, like, say, a planet in the space-time field, and that planet bends and warps the space to create gravity.
True, yeah.
But the other way to put it, and the way that Einstein originally came to understand it, and I don't know the truth of this, but it's just something I've heard Zizek say, okay, is that, in fact, no, there's a warping in the space-time continuum. And then because of that warping, a mass is collected.
Mm.
That the warp precedes the arrival of the massive matter.
It's like the warp is a pre-pattern in which the solid mass actually is a pattern that emerges in that pre-pattern. Yes, I think that's a more thorough way of looking at Einstein's ideas, actually, because they were counterintuitive for precisely that particular reason, that they didn't follow the Newtonian mechanics perspective where things are like billiard balls, and it brought forth invisible dimensions of reality, such as space-time continuum, or, you know, this whole stuff of, you know, the fabric of space-time warping and condensing into pockets of matter that exert a gravitational disequilibrium. I can't say disequilibrium, but I guess non-homogeneity of some sort. And I think that, yeah, that seems pretty consistent. But I'm suspecting you're making a point from there.
When it comes to understanding the trauma that persisted in Rwanda, you can't only look at the particulars of the players. In other words, you can't only look at the way the Belgians had particular interests and tried to push forward a narrative onto the people of Rwanda, but you have to ask what were the conditions such that was successful, and even more, that story persisted. What trauma was built into the system rather than what caused the trauma, what allowed this trauma arise?
I think, so, yeah, that's a good question.
And I have a little bit of an answer, which I think that you can see it maybe in India as well, which is that, you know, yes, you can, the trauma of British rule persists, but it also is, I would guess that it also is useful to explain some of the difficulties that India is undergoing as it modernizes and shifts away from one mode of life to another, as it goes from being a country or a nation where most of the production and most of the agriculture is subsistence farming, to one which is modernized, industrialized, focused on urban areas and fully integrated into a global market.
Right.
And that you can talk about the British rule, and that's not like to be ignored, but that the problems that are probably on the plate right now can't be separated from that British rule, but also persist. I mean, like that, the way that the England flung itself across the world had as much to do with the process of modernization and capital formation as it did to do with anything in the British character. And I would say that what's persisting really is that mode of life, which is still developing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, soon enough, I think probably, but even in my lifetime, China and India will either become equal with the West or surpass the West in terms of GDP, and modern and being thoroughly modern.
Right. I also feel and I also hope that by that time, this whole way of comparing progress in terms of GDP also becomes redundant and, you know, something a little outdated.
Yeah, me too. Me too. But the fact is that with the growth of GDP in different parts of the world comes different kinds of pressures.
Mm.
And I'm going to sound like, you know, when you become a man, you have to take responsibility, son.
Well, yeah. or something along those lines. Not just like a father and a son, but even like a older senior in school who is telling, you know, their juniors with the same elderly brotherhood right. kind of thing. But nobody knows what the fuck they're doing.
But I'm indoctrinating you into a horrible system, which is ought to be, you know, replaced. But the truth is, like, it's not so much you take responsibility, but that you're – that as capital concentrates, certain kinds of decisions become – made for you. Like, you have to expand into other territory. You have to find new markets. You have to develop new fields of labor and find new consumers, both. And so all of that will bring with it a kind of imperialism, regardless of the culture that is going through that process. It's very difficult to resist.
Yeah,
China certainly has the potential and the capacity to be imperialist. India does too,
right?
And it's not saying that doesn't make, you know, anything in the past go away or get better,
right?
But like in Rwanda specifically, to go back to Rwanda, certainly the people who were the Tutsis who were killed in Rwanda were not responsible for setting up the conditions of their own murder, ethically or morally,
right?
But also the Hutus are neither responsible for the Belgians' actions to create those conditions, nor off the hook for their own actions after the case, right after that happened. But overall, if we really want to do something about these sorts of events, we have to go beyond the Newtonian view, maybe, of looking at, well, that set of actors moved in this way, and that we have to go and say, no, what was that space-time field
that set
all this in motion?
This is very fascinating. I just had like a deja vu of like several conversations we've had maybe last year around probably the same time, which were centered around a lot of this physics and metaphors of physics and you know, applying them in understanding consciousness or talking about consciousness and automatons and stuff like that. But coming back to what you're saying, yes, it's a paradigm related issue. It's again something to do with what lies in the blind spot of our current understanding of reality. And first of all, we have to accept that there's always going to be a blind spot in how we process reality, because the more we know, the more we keep on seeing that there is a, you know, the domain of uncertainty and what we don't know keeps on increasing proportionally. So we have to, first of all, you know, come to terms with that inevitability. It's an existential fact that we are not going to be able to circumvent. That's one thing I think is, you know, pretty basic. The second thing is that there is something. What's happening with human beings cannot be completely detached from what we see in nature. Although it is not exactly like what we see, what's going on in nature. But it's definitely different. Are you able to hear me? Yeah. So this particular paradigm-related blind spot that we have in understanding our human reality, I think that's one of the key areas on which we need to focus. I'm not saying that it's going to give instant solutions, but it will at least realign our focus from something that is banal, mundane, materialistic, superficial, and ultimately inconsequential in a very, very dangerous way, probably driving us to extinction or self-extinction. So we really need to focus, I think, on something that is fundamental, and that is related to a paradigm shift that is hidden in our blind spot.
That kind of brings us back to Adam Curtis's film in a way, because one of the things he's talking about is something like a paradigm, right? I mean, the Bill Hamilton, George Price, rationalist, geneticist, Darwinian, you know, Richard Dawkins style paradigm of understanding the world in a particular way. It's a scientific paradigm.
Yeah, now, scientific, before, reductionist, atheist, those would all characterize it, yeah.
But it's not just, you know, there are other ways to be reductionist and an atheist than this, right? It's it's a very specific kind of paradigm.
True.
I'm not saying that we shouldn't, you know, we should let every reductionist paradigm through, or but what came to mind as I was watching this for again was a book that I'm reading, or actually that I've been listening to on tape as I try to get out and walk a bit. I've been listening to a book called The Great Influenza, about the Spanish flu in 1918.
Okay.
And I like to listen to it while I'm walking because it's so nice outside that I need a reminder that I should do social distancing, that it's not that I'm not out of the woods. So I listen to this thing about the pandemic. But listening to it, it started out being about the Spanish flu, but then it went into the history of medicine and the changes that have happened in the realm of medical science. And actually, in America, the rather late introduction of science to the realm of medicine, you know, until pretty late into the 19th century, what you needed to do in order to become a doctor was go take about 6 months of lecture courses. And then you would get a degree, and you could practice medicine. You wouldn't touch a cadaver. You wouldn't look through a microscope. You wouldn't have any lab time at all. There was no written exam. In fact, someone tried to introduce a written exam to Harvard's medical school in the mid to late 19th century. And
that's fascinating.
The response from the Harvard administrators were, you can't introduce a written exam to our medical students. Most of them don't know how to write. You know, they didn't want to increase the standards for getting a doctor, you know, doctorate of medicine, because it was a cash cow for the university. And in any case, the point is that what had happened in the realm of medicine for years, for millennia, was that a certain approach and understanding to the body had held, and certain kinds of remedies were tried, with very little innovation, almost no innovation, and no big paradigm shifts. So there was the idea of the humors, and there was four different kinds of substances in the body, and you had to keep them in balance, and if people were sick, it might be because they had a buildup of a certain kind of fluid, maybe mucus or too much blood. You'd bleed them or give them some sort of diuretic or to get the fluid levels changed, to get them back in balance, or maybe you try to get them more fluid. But in any case, that's what was the major paradigm, and it didn't change until pretty close to the 20th century.
Right, right.
What was interesting is that what changed before the paradigm change, before the theoretical change, moving from like a miasma theory to a germ theory, was a methodological change. So like someone like Florence Nightingale came along, and rather than just doing the treatments that were traditional, she did statistical analysis.
True.
She didn't change. She still worked within the miasma theory, but she would like see what the results were and alter. So, like the idea you should wash your hands and create a sterile environment around patients was something that arose from statistical analysis rather than any particular theory.
True.
So I don't know what I'm getting at exactly, except to say that I think the idea of paradigms and the relationship of theory to knowledge, at least in the realm of medicine, is unclear. I guess an empirical approach, like a statistical approach based on probabilities, can do a lot of good, at least in the realm of medicine. I wonder how much good it could do us in the realm of politics.
No, it's you're right. I think that's first of all, even in medicine, it's tricky when we talk about statistics, and that's because of the astounding number of variables involved with human populations and human genetics, and the complexity of human biology itself. So even though there is a lot of predictability and diagnostic power that we have in our hands right now, and several amazing treatments for a lot of complex diseases, and we have the power to edit genes and theoretically do all kinds of reprogramming of biology, the variability in human beings is one of the given chinks in the armor when it comes to statistics, and that's also the reason why developing a vaccine takes time. It's because of this high variability and large number of parameters that need to be considered when talking about the variation in human biology. So medicine definitely is characterized by that particular zone of lack of confidence, statistical confidence, so to speak. So, yeah, I mean, unless you have something that works 100% in all kinds of people, you can consider it safe as something that you can administer to a large population. So, true, that is absolutely true. Coming to how we, it's something that we just cannot grasp. Now, when we go to social sciences and politics, we are not only adding the complexity of biology and this variability in our hardware, so to speak, or software, if that's more accurate, but it's also adding another new dimension to the complexity. It's the psychological dimension. And psychological dimension is several folds more complex than just the biological reality of the human animal. Because we each are extremely complex individuals, and our own lives are incredibly difficult to understand. I mean, if you ask a person how much they understand their own life, it's an ongoing work in progress all the time dealing with, and there are huge pockets of uncertainty and our own cognitive biases and our own blind spots about things that we haven't seen because of the unique circumstances that have shaped our individuality and our personality. Now, when you keep adding this one individual and putting that individual with another individual, and that's what we are in reality. We are all basically networks of individuals. And when we start extrapolating that biological complexity to multiple individuals, communities, societies, nations, and the world, we are really looking at something that we do not have. We not only don't have the computational power probably to crunch that kind of a model, but I don't even think we have a good stable theoretical framework to first articulate that problem. And maybe that's because of my lack of knowledge and my own blind spots about what's going on in this. But I don't think many people are working on this directly, and it's rare to hear something like this, or you'll have to really dig into the literature to find where the paradigm shifts hide. And that's our situation right now. I mean, it's very common to hear that nobody understands quantum mechanics. And now when you talk with young researchers who are working in quantum physics, they're tired of hearing that. They're like, well, we need to keep making progress. We can't just keep, hitting that axiom that nobody understands quantum mechanics, because that is actually interfering with the progress of understanding quantum mechanics. But if you think about quantum physics, it's an old idea. I mean, it's something that came around at the turn of the 20th century. So we still, how many people actually can confidently talk about it? I know I can't. There are a lot of people who would really struggle to convey that idea to the layperson. Okay. They're still trying to figure it out amongst themselves in the academic circle. So forget sure. about it. Yeah. So what happens with this kind of stuff is that more and more rapid paradigm shifts are going to basically lead to fewer and fewer people actually getting what's going on.
Jump in here introduce two things. One is, I'll kind of maybe try to close out this question about the paradigm shifts, because the question that I was posing was, can we live without paradigms? In other words, is there a way to operate in a way that's theory free by doing something like statistical analysis or probability studies or things like that. And my, I'm guessing your answer is pretty much no.
No.
Right. So, okay, that's good to know, because that gives philosophy a role again. And then the a certain kind of rationality, a purpose. But then the other question I have is, when you're talking about a situation where the paradigms, the amount of confidence that you have in the various paradigms is low, something like a rhetoric might emerge to reinforce it. And this reinforce, like, let's say the humans are really gene carriers and are dictated, the genes are directing us rather than the other way around. It's interesting to think about how Diane Fossey played a role in Adam Curtis' story.
Right,
and
right.
Why was she there? What was the narrative point of her introduction into the story, do you think?
I think she does represent the Western mind's curiosity to understand nature and to observe it in its wild type setting and get a deeper glimpse into how nature works. So she represents that aspect of the Western mind, an empirical an approach to understanding our existential reality. So I think that's what she represents. At least that's how I perceived her role.
One thing that she represents is that a drive to study primates, gorillas, in a context which is not cultural or political.
Right.
Right. In other words, to understand humanity through the lens of the animal kingdom means understanding humanity in a way where the questions of politics and culture and economics are all thrown aside. Basically, to try to understand humans without having to understand psychology or sociology.
Mm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And this goes back to, like, you know, thinking of humans as – it's similar to thinking of humans as just carriers of genes. They're just animals. They're carriers of genes. We're living in really a natural system which operates by its own logic through us rather than something that we create.
Right.
But also, have you ever seen Jane I'm sorry, not Jane Goodall. Sigourney Weaver's movie Gorillas in the Mist?
No, I haven't, but that sounds amazing. I will definitely look it up.
I have not seen it. I think I've seen it, but it's been so long, I barely remember it.
Mm.
I was 17 when it came out.
Mm.
Adam Curtis does a good job of taking this woman who was kind of a hero in the 80s and 90s, even after she died, and making her seem like exactly the sort of person that gives the environmentalists a bad name.
Yeah, yeah. Right? I know. I did notice that too, because he clubs her in that narrative that he's talking about the colonialists splitting the Rwandans. So yeah, that was I noted that as well. That
she shows up right after an interview with a soldier who talks about torturing black men because he conceived of them as animals.
Right.
And the line about her is that she didn't think of the Africans as animals because she liked animals.
Mm-hmm,
It was very biting the way she was depicted. And do you know how she died? If you're looked into this. She was murdered in like what after the movie came out or after the book was optioned to be a movie. Actually, she died before the movie came out. She died in 1985 and she was murdered in her hut by a machete, and it's unclear as to they've never really gotten to the bottom of who did it. They charged a colleague of hers with it, but he was never actually brought to trial for it because he left and went back to, I guess, the UK or the United States. I don't remember.
The last entry in her diary read, when you realize the value of all life, you dwell less on what is past and concentrate more on the preservation of the future. That's pretty wild. That's the last thing that she ever wrote.
Interesting, though. It's the preservation of the future rather than the creation of the future, right? Mm. So
that's a very environmental mindset as well, and one that I definitely resonate with because it's relevant.
Yeah. So I guess what I'm struggling with here is to try to one of the things about Adam Curtis's films is that I really like them because it precisely because they take some cherished idol of, let's say, a certain kind of left or liberal perspective and smash them on the ground. Like they take Diane Fossey and smashes her image on the ground. On the other hand, you can't really abandon the idea that we should want to conserve the natural world or conserve, parts of our environment which aren't under our direct control, that there's a need for conservation in the world and that we've and a need for more rational kind of planning around where we develop and what parts of the world are taken up to be transformed and what should be set up as reserve, conserved habitat or what have you. But on the other hand, it does seem to fold in a certain part of the environmental movement folds in with a very anti-humanist perspective, which Curtis does a good job of showing to be a bit unhinged, and also an idea that can be folded in with the worst aspects of and worst atrocities.
True.
In the modern world,
it's a paradox. It's definitely a paradox. I feel.
Have you heard about this Michael Moore movie that's coming out? I forget what it's exactly called.
I did see something on that on social media, and it's supposed to be not good. It's supposed to be hurting the environmental argument or something like that.
Well, let's see. His new film is called – I haven't seen it, obviously. I don't even know the name of it. But the name of it kind of gives the game away. It's called Planet of the Humans. And he's – I'm not sure what the controversy is, but exactly. But my guess would be that he's treating humans as the problem rather than the solution maybe.
We are the problem and the solution. I mean, I think we should start accepting paradoxes and get on with it, because I think that's one of our biggest problems, and we waste a lot of time because we try to resolve the paradox when certain paradoxes are inherent. And if that is the nature, it should not be it should not be surprising that that's human nature, because we are full of internal contradictions as individuals and as social collectives. So it should not be surprising, and we should just basically learn how to deal with it. I think what happens is we get stumped when it comes to paradoxes, and that's where we lose the opportunity for getting the hang of a paradigm shift. And I think that's where a lot of time, energy, and words and lots is wasted. But I'm saying this very casually and very easily, as if I'm standing on a soapbox over here, but I deal with it myself, and I see lots of people struggle with it, as well. So I think it's a human condition, to not be able to deal with that paradox, because of which we miss the opportunity, glimpse into, what else is there.
Right. Well, I mean, the thing about paradoxes is that they're not that far away from what Hegel might call a contradiction, or Marx might call like a contradiction. And so when you have a contradiction, they're not just problems. When you encounter these paradoxes, from a Hegelian perspective anyway, they're not just problems, but they're actually foundational. Like,
absolutely, I believe that for sure.
Like that's what generates a whole system of thought is this paradox at the heart of it. So like in our society, the paradox of freedom and slavery, existing at the same time through a particular mode of production where everyone has to work and give over their will in order to have the freedom to consume what they want. Is maybe one way of thinking about the contradiction in our society, or the contradiction between wanting to preserve nature and at the same time by in consequence thinking of yourself as apart from nature,
right?
At the same time, or if you think of yourself as not being apart from nature, as happens in this movie, then you think of yourself as being like a machine.
True. And you know, we were talking about this last time, and I was going on and on about this whole thing that they made in the documentary, in the first part at least, or the first couple of the first two parts of the documentary. I was criticizing the thinkers and the scientists and the modelers that they made lots of assumptions about nature, and those assumptions are what we are basically trying to unravel, and that's really our biggest challenge and obstacle to get beyond these next few steps before we start making, you know, actual paradigm shifts. And that is true, that when we consider ourselves as machines, is because we have made machines based on how we understood nature. Like every machine, even if we take the wheel, you know, or something very prototypical like a gear. We have figured these mechanisms out by observing nature and kind of adapting that idea from nature to serve some objective that we had. So rolling logs gave us the idea to, increase our efficiency of transporting heavy material from one place to another. So we have essentially, instead of, you know, we have not just deified nature, but we have also adapted her logic and her patents to create the tools and technologies that we created. But as the complexity of this process increased over a short period of time, I mean, in this, on the scale of the universe, we are really recent creatures on planet Earth. So the rate at which the complexity increase is pretty much like all those exponential graphs we are seeing, you know, every day since the coronavirus pandemic. So it's exponential, and that's, I think, verifiable. I mean, nobody's going to deny that human history gets more and more complex at an accelerated pace with every passing year. So this acceleration is something that is increasing the rate of error in our construction of society. And this is just an hypothesis. So because we were in a rush to make machines based on the logic of nature, we created machines that we can't deal with. And perhaps if we were Vulcans or, you know, the Romulans, we would probably have a much better understanding of, how to create better technologies. But clearly, even in Star Trek, conflict exists at a galactic scale. So maybe getting over these paradoxes is probably still a long way in the future.
I think the way to get over paradoxes is to create new ones.
True.
Thomas Kuhn. Have you ever heard of Thomas Kuhn?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so he's the guy who started this notion, who came up with the phrase paradigm shift.
Right. Is he the one with the structure of scientific revolutions? Is he the guy?
Yes,
yeah,
that's right.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you might want to take a look at that book, and maybe we could talk about it in a future conversation.
True.
Because
we definitely can do that. I'll look into it. I was reading that at some point, and I think it got lost in
Okay, so you have, but I mean, he's a very big name, he came along after Popper. And Popper had the idea that the way you could tell whether something was science or not was whether or not it could be falsified, right?
Right.
If you had a theory that there was no way to falsify, then it wasn't really a scientific theory.
True. Yeah.
And Thomas Kuhn would say, well, you know, that sounds great, but in practice, no theory is ever really falsified. What happens is you find evidence that is anomaly and, you know, presents an anomaly for the theory, and then the theory is modified so that it can, that this new anomalous data can be fit within it.
Right.
The way that the paradigm shift happens isn't because you falsified your theory. It's because a new theory has been developed that some people feel as has a greater capacity to explain more, And the people who believe the first theory don't stop believing it. They simply are outmaneuvered by a new rising power within the scientific community of young students who were believing in the new theory, and eventually all the old theorists die out, and this a new so
that's like scientific the change gene. Arrives through that's like the selfish gene.
Right. The new scientific theories arise through funerals rather than through falsification.
Yeah, this is very parallel, and I'm familiar with this particular argument against Popper, and there's another mm-hmm. parallel idea that all models are wrong, some are useful. And that's also a very important thing to keep in mind whenever modeling concepts, especially when you're talking about systems or systems thinking. So this is true that our constant understanding of reality is a Sisyphus kind of a situation. Isn't that the myth where he's like carrying that thing up a hill
and a boulder up a mountain?
Yeah, and when I used to use this example in my classes, I remember saying something like, now there's all this infinite abyss void of unknown out there, and whether that gives you existential anxiety and makes you stop living, or you take that as an opportunity to know more and more because of your endless curiosity. It's a choice that you have to constantly make while we, you know, maneuver through this phenomenology, I suppose. And it's an endless process. I mean, it's rather silly to think that we are going to arrive at ultimate conclusions, because there is no absolute reality that you can capture with an ultimate conclusion. We're just going to keep on jumping from conclusions, and we're going to change some conclusions, we're going to modify some, we're going to let go some are just going to go extinct, like, you know, tribes and languages and cultural practices. And I think we cannot do jack shit about it, because it's first of all getting faster and faster. And it's not going to stop. I don't see how it's going to stop. I mean, tomorrow, do you envision the world has just like gone into an archaic revival? It's not going to happen. So
I don't know what's going to happen, but it does seem that the world has stopped in a way. But let me throw one more thought at you, or question at you here. Last night I was, after reading a little bit or listening to this book on the Spanish influenza and the development of germ theory and all of that, I asked my wife, who's a nurse, whether she thought that eventually, sometime in the future, there would become a point where we looked back on germ theory the way we look back on the theory of the humors and the fluids and all of that today, or look back on my asthma theory. And she said no. She thought the germ theory was right. And the reason why was, I mean, she wasn't like, you know, she was thoughtful about it, but she said with some confidence that, you know, you look through a microscope, you see the germs. They've discovered some sort of truth about the world and the body. And that's probably not, I mean, it will be modified, but it'll probably never be abandoned. There won't be a paradigm shift away from it. Mm. What do you think?
I mean, it's a solid thought for sure. I'm not going to,
Yeah, you believe in the germ theory.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, I do too. Yes. Like everybody does.
But it also, the argument is a very interesting one to consider, because think about how we came to this understanding being provided with incontrovertible evidence for germs as a source of diseases. We had to invent a microscope. Okay, so it's a tool that we had to invent. We had to update our eyes that nature equipped us with by an unreal scale to be able to see something that is absolutely invisible. I mean, I think the same way about the DNA, discovery of the DNA structure or the DNA molecule, and the fact that it is the code that runs all of life. I mean, this is something that no other creature, as far as we know, has the privilege of knowing. It's something that we have figured out through this long process of ratiocination and, you know, gathering evidence, applying analysis, drawing statistics, imagination, creativity, and ingenuity, and putting all that together. We have discovered things that are absolutely, nature did not equip us to look into. So the fact that we believe in germ theory is not, you know, it's the reason for that is the existence of the microscope, which is a feat of ingenuity and creativity and imagination and science. And
right.
So it's the same thing. I mean, when if tomorrow we have tools and detectors and technology that allows us to see dimensions that we cannot access right now, then, you know, yeah, I mean, warp speed and, you know, hyperspace and traveling through multiple universes might be the point where we would probably look at germ theory as we look at, you know, something a little more dated. Maybe
not. Why are we so sure that looking at something at its smallest components is going to get us closer to the truth?
No, when I said multiple universes, hyperspaces, and, you know,
I know. I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just like, right, I know. Just like, we need to, like, so we kind of assume, well, like I said to my wife, well, you know, there, we could go down one more level. We could look at quarks or atoms or like that.
Yeah.
But it's like, oh, yeah, but we could also somehow maybe look up, get a bigger and bigger picture, more and more of the totality, and then understand
about
our bodies
that for sure, which is very relevant to politics and social sciences. So, since we have been talking about this, you know, since the past few conversations, this idea that I've been trying to really process in my head, which I've been struggling with, is how we scale up our biological reality all the way to the social reality. And that's really where the problems start. I mean, all the criticisms for, you know, the social implications of selfish gene type of models or Darwinian, models, applying them to economics and society is the problematic because of these difficulties to scale up from the reductionist model to something as abstract as a social model. So if you look at this as a systems problem, what we're looking at is emergent behavior. So in other words, the property of wetness that water possesses is something that starts emerging only when a certain critical number of water molecules have come together. So this whole idea of wetness then emerges out of that collective accumulation of the microscopic water, right? So when we look at human beings and society at large, and especially in the context of this system that we are all part of, whether we talk about it as economically connected, socially connected, politically connected, geopolitically connected, environmentally connected, whatever, you know, angle you want to put on it, this large network of human beings that we represent as a larger organism is an emergent property. So society is an emergent property from biology. And so we will definitely, you know, the rules that we apply to study cells and, you know, talk about homeostasis, we can't scale them exactly on the level of the society. But it is certainly something that emerges out of the fundamental rules of biology. But it is not something that you can reduce to those same rules. Does that make sense? It's an emergent thing. For sure.
Yeah, it is. I definitely think that there's something to that. And I wonder if there's also a difference in quality there too, because it seems as though when you're talking about social systems that when you're talking about biological system, maybe this is both true, but when you're talking about biological systems, what you're dealing with is a system of concrete facts, whereas when you're talking about social systems, you're talking about a relationship between kinds of understanding and the facts. So, you know, there's the subject-object split doesn't rise up at the level of germs,
right.
But it does rise up at the level of people in a society.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But I also think that it, even at the level of the germs, it's the same thing. Like when we, even with our understanding of biology, however much, I mean, it is incredibly, incredibly advanced. Like, if you think about it for, Dian Fossey's apes, walking upright and figuring out the secrets of the universe and smashing atoms and figuring out the structure of the DNA, that's, like, incredibly impressive for a short period of time on planet Earth. I mean, that's really, really small amount of history on scale of changes that happen in physics, right? So that's impressive. That's very impressive. And when we look at what we understand about biology from our present understanding, maybe there's a whole lot that we don't understand and we have not even discovered yet, which would probably shift our paradigms in remarkable ways, which is what we were talking about earlier. And I think that would translate to our understanding of society too. Like, we may not figure it out at, a much more meta level, but certainly we can probably get over our current adolescence, maybe. If we can compare our present state in history as that of a teenager, dealing with adolescent issues and, hormonal disequilibrium that is completely beyond in their control, but, comes as clockwork. That maybe maybe entire humanity is going through that sort of a difficult phase. But then maybe there's hope that we will probably have, more mature understanding or ways of dealing with it in the future. So I'm, again, as usual, optimistic about those kinds of things. But there's always evidence that once in a while you have that bummer of a day when you're like, oh God, this world, like, what happened in India with all the liquor shops opening and social distancing going for a toss like within hours. I was like, oh God, what was that?
Yeah. This is like, maybe I'll put a break here and we can do a little COVID segment here at the very end. So, how do you think, things are shaping up in terms of the global response to COVID-19?
The global response. Now, isn't that a tricky question? Like, it's like, how do you answer that question? Because
The reason I ask it that way is because I've noticed that people are very quick to focus in on particular world leaders or figures or countries in ways that don't obviously make sense. So, like, a week ago, I noticed everyone was very quick to say that the United States had handled the COVID-19 outbreak in the absolute worst way because of Trump, and that we had the absolute worst outbreak in the whole world. And then you look at the numbers and that isn't the case. Mm-hmm. First of all, in the United States, there hasn't been one response. There's been at least 50 because the governors are all dealing with this differently.
Yes.
And then the other thing is the numbers aren't true. It's not true that our outbreak is the worst. We have a lot more cases.
Mm-hmm.
And we may have the most deaths of any nation, but we're a very big nation. So the question to ask is, why is our outbreak so much worse than, say, China's or India's, for that matter? But the truth is that you're seeing, at least in Europe and the United States, a sort of similar level of failure, I think, across the board.
Mm-hmm.
And that in Asia, a similar level of success, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not clear to me that whether or not that success is just a phantom or not.
Well, so many problems in dealing with this particular beast, right? First of all, there are problems with data. There are problems with how we are crunching it. So the error margins and error bars, we have to deal with error bars in real time. That's like a bad situation. If you can put error bars on a graph and sit back and for hours, days, or months stare at it and then figure out what you want to say in a manuscript, that's a different situation. But the problem with COVID is that it's happening in real time, and so those error bars are going to constantly interfere with our interpretation of that situation.
Mm-hmm.
The second is that every country is showing such remarkably different patterns of not just the stats, like the infection rates, the recovery rates, and the death rates, but also the handling, the data that is associated with handling the situation. Like, for example, all the efficient tracing that was done in South Korea, right?
Mm-hmm.
The advanced methods used in China to contain everything based on data you know, data and data processing and algorithms, right? And in India, they have been praised for strict lockdown, and then except for this recent fiasco. And Sweden has their maverick approach, which is grossly misunderstood and miscommunicated to a lot, in the media, because they are actually taking all kinds of means. They're just not being extremely anal about it. They're being pretty cool about how they're dealing with it. So it's again, like, all these nations are like, individual personalities, and this reaction to COVID is expressed in their own personality traits. And when we think about the US from Canada, we're like, what the hell is going on? It's like, it seems like a different planet over there. And then when we look at India, it's different. And over here, we are fortunately, it's been pretty much constant in terms of how people are obeying the social distancing rules, and the numbers are not that crazy in Canada. But overall, globally,
but in Canada, you might ask something like, "Well, what is the density of population?"
Yes,
in general.
Yes, it's not very dense, and that is a huge part of why most of these rural places have, like, I think one province still does not have any cases at all. So right. you would get that because of the remote geography and population density.
And in India, I have to wonder, to what degree has there been adequate testing?
Yes, so that's one thing. And actually, a better indicator would be how much is the healthcare actually seeing fatalities related to COVID, or having a situation where they are not able to deal with emergency response. Now, that hasn't been reported at all in India. They have been talking about positive cases and deaths, but they are not talking about, overwhelming healthcare system where there's an inadequacy in terms of dealing with this situation.
You compare, like, the United States, total number of tests per 1 million. It's 23,000 tests have been given out for 1 million, every 1 million people in the country. In India, it's something like 200 tests.
Mm.
So no, I'm sorry, 864 tests.
Yeah, I haven't looked at any of these numbers million. In a long time. It just started becoming very hazy after a while. So, but yeah,
the reason why I'm mentioning that is that's probably correlating with the lack of actual medical response to real outbreak. In other words, I don't know what India's medical system is like. My bias tells me it's not as good as the medical system in most of Europe and even the United States, say, so that people have less access to medical care.
Yes, it's decent. It's like most other things in India, but you're right. I mean, it's not as advanced and sophisticated in terms of equipment and expertise and talent.
What about access? I mean, that's a...
You could get access even in remote rural areas. Okay. You would find an infirmary or a clinic. There would be some exceptions. I'm not going to generalize it. And it might not be great. They might not be prepared to deal with, big emergencies. So one of the things people are worried about and have been talking about is the huge migration of all the rural population from the cities back to their villages. And
right.
So far, we have not seen anything emerging in terms of data that has, struck out.
The other thing is to track where people are in this outbreak in time, because, Italy is further down the line than the United States. Mm-hmm. They got their outbreak before we got ours, right?
Right.
When did India get its first first case?
And that was much later, I remember. Much later, not like in terms of, weeks, but or maybe just a few days or maybe a week. We started seeing.
So they're about a week out?
I would say, like a few days or a week. Again, I have not looked at the data in like a long time because it just became too much. I just couldn't, it stopped making sense. And it's been a while since I've actually looked at any of the numbers.
Right. Yeah. So then there's a big problem for us right now is that there's these motivations. We're motivated to make certain kinds of claims depending on who we are.
Right.
So if you're on the right in the United States, you're going to be absolutely convinced that China is hiding its true death count and they're responsible for purposely sending us the virus or something like that. And if you're on the left, you're going to be possibly saying, oh, we had because of Trump, we've had the absolute worst response to. But the truth is, there's so much data and so much information that side-by-side comparisons between one country or another or one region to another are not going to be immediately sensible.
Right.
You have to know a lot of pretty fine detail to make comparisons. And I think it's important to all that to always try to keep in mind, what are we trying to discover?
Yeah.
Are we trying to discover who we want to blame or what we need to do?
No, this whole thing, blame game, is a good point you bring up, because I was talking to my friend and we were essentially, you know, talking about the same issue, that as time goes by with this pandemic hovering for longer and longer period of time, our political proclivities are going to just basically start emerging into new patterns. And what we are hearing when people's political biases and their tendencies of constructing a worldview based on those biases is basically now expressing out. And most of it that is happening on social media. I mean, this is a great, great data science, social science project for someone in the future to take up. Like everything that was going on before COVID and after COVID in terms of social media sentiment analysis or you know, language processing of what we are talking about. Because it's really, really putting those things out there. I mean, I find myself being like very when I have to say anything on social media. Even the video chats that we are having, it's like, it feels a little surreal. I mean, if we were doing this in a non-COVID kind of a situation, it would have been probably different how that tangible thing feels compared to now. Because now all the computers, all the entire machine is like active with data packets, you know, uploaded and downloaded all over the world. So it's interesting. And it's all this political bubbling that's going on. All over the world, there is this. It's a freak out, man. I mean, how do I tell you? Yeah, it's a freak out. Yeah. It's a happening, like what they used to call, you know, at Grateful Dead concerts, or you know, it's something like that. I mean, it's happening, and it's not far fetched, because you have a virus that has pretty much gotten the entire species, a large percent of it, completely immobilized. And it's a virus. I mean, forget about leaders and all that. That comes later. The real story that's unfolding over here is between the single cellular invisible creature, which is so simple that it just has a small DNA code wrapped up in a protein envelope with spikes on it, which has essentially engaged in this interesting biological drama with an organism whose population is, you know, 7 billion plus, and whose individual body is made up of trillions of cells with, you know, much more complex hardware and software. That's the real story. And then the sub-story is all this political stuff that is happening all over the world and, you know, at different levels. I mean, I'm sure Donald Trump has his own existential crisis to deal with the coronavirus, and, you know, all the other leaders of every country are dealing with, you know, that as well. So I mean, he's got his narrative fucked up because of the pandemic. Because, well, how is he going to deal with the election thing? And you know, it's a curveball for them, and for all of us as individuals.
Do you think there's going to be a vaccine?
Well, there are some promising reports coming from places. I mean, in fact, one of the companies over here in where I'm staying in Dartmouth, in Halifax, Nova Scotia, they had some potential leads for you know, getting a virus going, sorry, a vaccine going in a couple of months, it seems. And there are other reports as well from India and I think UK. It's again, we are dealing with a medicine-related issue that we were talking about earlier. To be able to make this effective in a large population without the inherent idiosyncrasies, you know, making it worse than, you know, it has to be. All of these things we will have to first get a good grip on before we can say, well, now we have, you know, defeated coronavirus and we have, you know, it's now just like the common you know, flu, and it will not bother us again, and you know, everything will be all fine, and we will live happily ever after. If that situation is, I think, far, but again, who knows? I mean, if there's a big breakthrough with all this glorified biotechnology that we've been, you know, discussing.
When you say that's far, do you mean years away?
No. Well, see, that's the other thing I've been noticing right now. There's been a lot of discussion about how lots of vaccines haven't actually been produced. You know, for like something like HIV took a long time. And polio too, but and again, we're looking at different historical contexts and the kind of research power that probably, you know, didn't exist in those times.
You're talking about decades then?
I want to say not decades, but I'm hesitating saying months, and so I don't know, somewhere in between, man. I mean, and this is again really hard because I have faith in the, you know, the technological solution, because that's the only solution that we are going to have to deal with this problem in an effective way. I don't think there's a political solution. There is no philosophical solution. The only solution is a technological solution to deal with this problem. I mean, if I'm praying for anything, if anything that I'm defying these days is you know, bioscience and, you know, science really.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a perfect spot to end our official conversation, so I'm going to stop recording.